Watkins versus Idaho Transportation Department, representing the appellant, James Johnson, representing the respondent, Susan Cervic. Mr. Johnson, you may present the appellant's opening argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you for having me here today. There are three issues I have named and briefed, and the state has responded to. These are whether Sergeant Middleton had legal cause to stop Mr. Watkins, whether the inaccurate and unreliable statements in the PC affidavit cause it to fail the requirements of Idaho Code 18-8002A4, thus invalidating the suspension, and three, whether the hearing officer erred in ruling that Sergeant Middleton was certified to administer a breath test based on the evidence properly before the hearing officer. So addressing these in turn, clearly, Mr. Watkins takes issue with the use of Idaho Code 49910 as a reason to stop him when it does not apply to him. As argued below, we maintain that 49910 addresses equipment and by implication, equipment failures, and the equipment on Watkins' truck was intact in perfect condition. The cause for the stop, if we were to step in Officer Middleton's shoes, should be driving behavior unless Watkins had damaged equipment or altered equipment. But Middleton made the leap from an equipment statute to a conclusion that Watkins' driving behavior was unlawful. 49910 doesn't address behavior at all, and the equipment was perfect. Now,
wasn't a similar argument rejected in State versus Patterson?
Yes, that was my next paragraph, Your Honor. And I think that, Patterson 140, Idaho 612, the state has offered it for support for the proposition that a broken taillight can support a traffic stop. And indeed, the phrase white light to the rear is part of their presentation or their response briefing in this. We maintain that Patterson is perfectly a good case, except that what Patterson was dealing with was a broken taillight, so he had broken equipment. And furthermore, that Patterson's taillight is emitting light from a taillight, which is mounted on the rear of the vehicle. So we don't contest Patterson, we just contest that it doesn't apply to this case because the light at issue in this case is not on the rear of the vehicle.
But wasn't the argument in Patterson that the statute under which he was stopped was, as you are arguing here, an equipment violation, and so it couldn't be the basis for a moving violation? And didn't we reject that under 49902?
I would have to concede that you did address it. You had it morphed over 49902, but my reading of Patterson was that defense attorney, the appellant's attorney, said, "Well, look, this light emitting from the taillight was both red and white, and the statute didn't proscribe that." My view of it was because the equipment itself was not intact, correct, and it did allow this extra light that the court ruled that no, that's really not what the law is addressing here. We want the equipment to be correct, but still, it morphed into a moving violation, and indeed, Mr. Watkins was driving his car at the time that his auxiliary light was on. But I would still say that this is distinguished from Patterson because indeed his lenses were all intact and his lenses that were an issue were not on the rear of the vehicle.
Thank you.
So moving on, that I would say that 49910 does not put the driver on notice that if a driver accidentally activates the switch or leaves a door open, that he is driving with a cargo light on, that he is violating a law. 49 and 10 says that a driver has to have lenses that are a certain color. The statute itself is perfectly fine, but it doesn't say what Officer Middleton wants it to say, which is apparently that it violates a code against white light to the rear. That's not part of the statute. And in contrast, I've supplied statutes from two of our sister states, Oregon and Washington, which prescribe behaviors, that is, don't shine your spotlight onto another driver's windshield, or don't use it when your vehicle is in use on the highway. These are two specific and really easily copied statutes that tell a driver, don't do this. If you look at the Washington statute, every lighted spot lamp shall be so aimed and used that no part of the high intensity portion of the beam will strike the windshield or windows or mirrors of an occupant of another vehicle in use. In other words, don't turn this light on if it will strike another vehicle being used on the highway. Well, the Oregon statute, auxiliary lights mounted higher than 54 inches shall not be lighted when the vehicle is in use. That's pretty clear. It puts a driver on notice not to activate a high-mounted light 54 inches higher than the ground while you're driving. And if an Idaho driver were subject to those statutes in Idaho, Watkins would have been in violation, but he is not in violation of the Idaho law that Middleton used to stop him. From there, I'd like to move on to whether we should use a Louisiana court's interpretation of their law and whether it has any applicability here. That Louisiana court case, the Brown case, gave great deference to their troopers' belief, as their own court said, their troopers' belief that a rear-facing white lamp was unlawful. Well, that gives an awful lot of legal interpretation to a cop on the street. It is just not Idaho law that a white light to the rear is unlawful. If that is what the Idaho legislature deems to be unlawful, it is time they said as much, just as the Oregon legislature and the Washington legislature has done. Giving that kind of deference to a law enforcement is dangerous business, especially when the words of the statute don't come close to authorizing traffic stops. And as far as the reference to the Neal case in my brief, and the states responded to my argument about Neal, our reading is that the situations before the court are very analogous in that the driving behaviors in Neal, touching or crossing a fog line, which for years have been used for reasons for traffic stops, that traffic driving behavior was finally deemed to be lawful. The Neal court isn't necessarily recommending that as a way to drive, but the court reined in law enforcement's carte blanche on stopping motorists. And the failure to maintain lane, which was a phrase used quite often in law enforcement parlance, was a lot closer to the words of the statute than white light to the rear is in the case in front of us. At least touching a fog line is driving behavior, and mistakenly having a cargo light on is not really driving behavior. And at least in Oregon and Washington, a driver is on notice to be careful about the lights. Finally, the district court in our case relied on the Louisiana court in deciding that the hearing officer got it right in accepting the ITD proffered Louisiana case. First, the hearing officer is not really authorized to be interpreting Louisiana law or even Idaho law. The facts before the hearing officer are the same as before this court, and the facts have never been in dispute. This case is strictly a matter of law. The hearing officer is entitled to his opinion, but we all have the same facts. The question is, as a matter of law, does 49.910 make driving with that cab-mounted cargo light on unlawful? The statute simply does not apply. So the hearing officer was out of bounds in making a legal interpretation, and the district court was out of bounds in deferring to a misguided legal analysis when the hearing officer is really only authorized to rule on facts and applicability to the law. The Louisiana law may have persuaded the ISP, it may have persuaded Idaho Transportation Department, but it should not persuade this court. The Louisiana court went out of bounds on its own statute, and this court should not follow that example. Next, I'd like to move on to the PC affidavit. The district court made its point in its ruling that Watkins, quote, Watkins did not carry his burden in demonstrating that the results should not be relied upon, end quote. That is not the burden that Watkins needed to carry. It was our burden to show that the procedural protections that the state is required to afford to a driver were simply not provided. In short, the purported sworn statement that is required under 18802A sub 4 may have been provided, but it was inherently defective in that it was internally inconsistent to the point of contradicting itself within its narrative. The inconsistencies in the provided statement are not on the order of using an improper form, being signed by a different officer than one who administered a breath test or a field sobriety test, or lacking an original signature. What the proffered PC affidavit provided were substantive inconsistencies, which make the document inherently unreliable. Specifically, part of the narrative of that PC affidavit describes stopping Mr. Watkins, interacting with him, and having him blow. At the end of the statement, the document unambiguously states that Watkins refused to blow. This is a quote. Watkins refused to submit to a blood test. Next line, refused blood test. And there was no breath testing specialist certification number provided for the officer administering the test. So again, the district court got it wrong in stating that Watkins did not meet his burden. These are procedural safeguards set in place by the legislature to make sure that law enforcement is properly administering the test and following the law in doing so. So I'd like to offer this as a comparison. Say an officer, a respected detective, provided a written affidavit in support of an application for a search warrant. Say that the affidavit contained absolutely contradictory statements, such as the subject submitted to a lie detector test, and then stated that the subject did not submit to a lie detector test. Given totally contradictory statements, one would hope that the magistrate receiving such an application would deny it, at least send it back for review and clarification at a minimum. Well, you might say that I'm comparing apples to oranges, but I'm not. We all trust that detectives do their jobs thoroughly, honestly, intelligently, and we have faith that they do, but we require that they attest to the facts that underlie their need for a search warrant. They have to put their name on a document that says, you can believe me, I've done my due diligence, and we are justified in getting a warrant. Just in this case, the officer is submitting his work to an impartial separate party, the ITD in this case, to say we need to suspend this driver's license, but the statement itself doesn't make sense. It is self-contradictory. Do we say, well, he's a good officer, and as he has been in the past, so we'll issue this suspension? No, this is a procedural safeguard that he submit a statement, a sworn statement that we rely on to support his actions in the field. And in his view, the facts of the case that mean, yes, we need to suspend a license. And that requirement spelled out in the statute is a paramount example of procedural due process. So it's no less so than an affidavit submitted to a magistrate in the application for a search warrant. You might say, Mr. Watkins, the stakes are a lot higher in invading a person's home, car, or person than they are in suspending driver's privileges. That's a pretty fuzzy line. What is more important than protecting procedural due process in one arena as opposed to another? I went through the Matthews v. Eldridge factors in my briefing. Number one, a private interest that will be affected by official action, the risk of an erroneous deprivation of such interest through the procedures used, and the probable value of additional or substitute procedural safeguards, and the government's interest, including the function involved in the fiscal and administrative burden that the additional procedural safeguard would entail. So I'm not going to belabor my briefing on this, but I think those are all addressed in this particular situation. And again, we have a direct contradiction in the body of that probable cause affidavit, and the affidavit is supplied to satisfy 18802A4, and that's mandatory. One part says he blew, one part says he refused, and no officer certification is provided. I want to emphasize that the procedure spelled out in the statute is not only easy to comply with, but is one of the few protections afforded the driver in this context. It is not hair splitting to say that this is different than using the wrong form, as this court used to amend the due process protection in King, nor that it didn't have a original signature, as in the Kalani Keegan case, or signed by an officer different than the test administrator, as in Atwood. Here, the contents of the statement directly contradict each other. It should not stand as a sworn statement, and therefore the suspension should be rescinded. Again, it is not Watkins' burden to make sure the state perform its duties. And the burden in this case was not to show that the test results were unreliable, as the district court stated. The sworn statement does not substantively comply with 18802A4, and those facts were before the hearing officer and the district court. Lastly, I want to address the search for the certification of Sergeant Middleton. And again, it's not Watkins' burden to show that Middleton was not certified. The hearing officer maintained it was not required that the officer show his certification. However, the IDAPA rules 11.03, 0.01, 0.014, 0.03 state that an officer must be certified. By inference, if that certification is challenged, then the state has to show that he is certified. And the only evidence before the hearing officer was that he was not certified, because that certification line is left blank on the PC affidavit. And the state did not rebut that, at least in the hearing. It's not up to the hearing officer to go and find evidence to support the field officer's position.
Mr. Johnson, did Mr. Watkins challenge that lack of certification at the ALS hearing?
That's my recollection. Well, no, we didn't challenge that he was certified. What we challenged was that there was no evidence of certification. And that may be sound like it's a fine line, but I guess in answer, that's the best I can do to answer your question. I think that I didn't know if Middleton was certified. I didn't know, and I actually looked and I didn't see that certification, as Ms. Cervic later pointed out in her briefing, that it was easily found on the ITD website. But it wasn't easy for me to find, because I looked and I couldn't find it until she in her later briefing and indicated how to find it. And granted, I am not a good cyber sleuth by any means, but I think the point of the matter is that if we don't have reliable information to start with, and we do say that there's no certification evident, that should be a failure on the part of the state to prevail in this situation. But I mean, I happen to know Middleton personally. I mean, we're not drinking buddies, but I've encountered him a few times in the past. I've been in a lawyer here for 20 years. He's a good officer. But I do think that the point that the certification is not evident or provided is significant. I think that's just part of their duty to show that in the PC affidavit. And that's why there's a blank on their form.
Thank you.
So while the impartiality of hearing officers may be viewed cynically by the defense bar, and an ALS hearing is the sort of a modicum of an impartial hearing provided by Idaho statute, hearing officer decided he was allowed to take what he called judicial notice of several arenas of law, naming case law, IDAPA, statutes, etc. But IDAPA allows for hearing officers to take official notice of facts that could be judicially noticed in the courts of Idaho. and of technical or scientific facts. Now, the district court noted that Watkins, meaning me, did not protest when the hearing officer announced at the end of the hearing he was going to take judicial notice of several things, including the ISP website utilized for breath alcohol analysis. That's in the opinion on page 10 of the district court's opinion. And the opinion stated that there was no indication Watkins objected to this method of obtaining information prior to or at the conclusion of the hearing. But it's unclear just what the phrase website utilized for breath alcohol analysis means. The website itself does not instruct officers on how to do the analysis or what there was for Watkins to protest or correct in the hearing officer's statement, not knowing that he intended to delve into the officer certification records. That only became obvious after the fact when the hearing officer provided his ruling that he had gone into the site. And in our opinion, that was a search that's outside the bounds of the official notice afforded to hearing officers afforded by the IDAPA ruling, or IDAPA rule 11.03.01.014.03A. The search into the ISP website doesn't qualify. The officer could proclaim that he was going to do any manner of action, but if he proclaimed that he was going to go outside the law in searching for evidence, it was not up to Watkins to challenge him on the spot. Let's say a hearing officer announced he was going to go to the site of the stop. No judge would claim that he was going to use judicial notice to gather evidence on that basis. It would be unlawful. So for a hearing officer to merely announce that he was going to go take judicial notice of something he was not authorized to do does not give it the imprimatur of law. Officer certifications don't qualify as being subject to judicial notice. That is why certifications are provided to defense counsel in discovery when a DUI involving a blow is going to go to trial. But it is legally necessary to submit those into evidence at trial, then get them admitted into evidence. It is not assumed. As we realize that the Idaho rules of evidence don't apply here, but if IDAPA refers to what judicial notice could be taken, IRE 201 says judicial notice is limited, a narrow scope on what the judge can take notice of. And Middleton's certification is not generally known, and the website should be out of bounds. It was not ever put into evidence of any sort to the hearing officer. Clearly, Middleton is certified. That's shown after the fact. But the horse was out of the barn. The evidence before the hearing officer was that there was no certification. That's the only thing that in front of him was the PC affidavit. And the officer, hearing officer, was not entitled to go on a fishing expedition to counter that evidence. At that point, if he goes on a fishing expedition, he's basically acting as an advocate for ITD. So in conclusion, for the reasons spelled out, we ask you to reverse the district court ruling and remand it with instructions to vacate the suspension.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Cervic, you may present the respondent's argument.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'll address the issues as presented by Mr. Johnson in the same order. Regarding the probable cause to stop the driver in this case, the facts are undisputed. There was a cargo light mounted on the rear of his vehicle. The cargo light was on and it was emitting white light to the rear of the vehicle. Idaho Code 49-910 states that all lighting devices and reflectors on the rear of a vehicle should be red in color, with a couple of exceptions. But here, with the exceptions for backup lights and a white light for the license plate. But here the cargo light was not a backup light. The cargo light was not illuminating the license plate. So on that basis, the driver was stopped. And when you read through the cases, there are policy reasons that this is important, because having white lights on in this kind of circumstance could distract other drivers. So on that basis, there was probable cause to stop the driver in this case. Watkins' attorney talks a lot about the Louisiana case. Frankly, there just aren't a lot of cases out there that talk about cargo lights. And that was just cited by the department's briefing for an example. But I think that the Patterson case supports the position of ITD is that in this case, that car was stopped for a broken tail light because it was emitted white light to the rear of the vehicle. Moving on to the due process challenge by the driver about the inaccurate statement in the police report. Well, that's true. There is an inaccurate statement in the police report. The policeman writes on one point on page 11 of the agency record that the driver refused the test. But every other reference to the testing in this case is that the driver took the breath test and he failed. So there's simply just one erroneous reference by the police officer. Now, I'm not advocating the police officer should have inaccurate police reports. They should not. But in this case, what's clear about the situation here is that's either a typo or a clerical error. And this isn't new to these agency decisions. This court has addressed this a couple of times when there have been inaccuracies in the documentation provided by the police or by the hearing officer. And those are cited in the briefing that we've provided. But one of the things I would point out is that the legislature has given a hearing officer specific grounds on which they can vacate a suspension. And inaccurate documentation is not one of them. So the hearing officer had no authority in this particular case, had no authority in this case to overrule the suspension based on inadequacies in the documentation. And finally, with regard to the officer certification, it was not provided in the documentation provided to the driver before the hearing, but in on the agency record document number one is entitled Notice of a Telephone Hearing. And on page 3 of that document, it talks about where the drivers can find things like officer certifications, instrument certifications, and other things. And what has happened over the last few years is those are all available now on a website so that they don't necessarily need to be provided in every packet because they're available to everyone on these websites. And that was the case with the officer's certification in this case. So the second part that's important about the officer certification is that a hearing officer can vacate a suspension if the driver can show that the evidentiary testing was not done in compliance with the law, IDAPA, or the standard operating procedures of ISP. But the burden of proof is on the driver to show that inadequacy. And here the driver simply failed to meet his burden of proof by showing that the officer wasn't certified. The hearing officer did what he's entitled to do and what he said he was going to do in his opinion. He went to the website, he determined that the officer was certified, which he was, and did not vacate the suspension. So we would request the court to uphold the decision of the district court and of the hearing officer.
Thank you, Ms. Cervic. Mr. Johnson, you may present the appellant's reply.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I'll be brief. I think I have to be brief. In regards to Ms. Cervic's argument that every other reference in the PC affidavit, I think is what she's referring to, or the other evidence before the hearing officer was that the driver blew, and this was merely a typo or a clerical error. But if you look at that document itself, the officer, the field officer, Middleton, had typed in that Watkins refused to blow. And I'm not sure what Officer Middleton was thinking at that point, but that's a clear contradiction to his earlier information in that. I mean, that's not an oversight. That's not a cut and paste, I don't believe. I don't know what he did, but it's not what I would regard as a typo if he's deliberately typed in the driver's name. And in response to the argument that the legislature gives the hearing officer specific grounds to overrule the suspension, the legislature also demands that that the procedural due process be followed by stating that this sworn statement be provided. And it strikes me that if the legislature just wanted the officer to just sign his name on a copy of the blow results, that would be one thing, but they're asking for a statement which implies a narrative, which would imply that the narrative all be accurate. It clearly wasn't accurate. And my argument against the provision of on what's labeled the State's Exhibit 1, I think, page 3 in this tiny font that says we can find these things, I believe that's provided as if we are to treat that as discovery. And things that are offered up in discovery aren't necessarily in evidence. Just because it was out there to be found doesn't mean that it was provided to the hearing officer in evidence. He went looking for it. And at that point, he's acting as an advocate. I don't think that's a legitimate search on his part. And with that, I have nothing further to add.
Thank you, counsel. The court appreciates the arguments of counsel today and your responses to our questions. This matter will be taken under advisement and a written opinion will be issued in due course. The court will be in recess until the 10:30 oral argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.